week's IMDb speaker series. Today we're very fortunate to have Jason Augustine and Jeremy Carson here from NSRDEC, which is the U.S. Army Natick Soldier Research, Development, and Engineering Center. And I'm actually not going to say very much because they have some stuff to introduce themselves. So let's get right to the talk.
Hey, well, thank you very much for hosting us. We're excited to be here. So we're here to talk a bit about some work that Jeremy and I have been doing to develop a more or less open source framework for doing virtual reality and serious gaming. I'll tell you why we're doing that. And Jeremy sort of is the star of the show because he's the sort of, as he puts it, the only programmer. Although I contend that I have contributed some code to the effort, but he's sort of the main guy in the code. So this is sort of the kind of high-level outline of what we're going to do. So I'll tell you a bit about why I care about VR. I actually am a cognitive scientist, so I study how people process information and make effective decisions. VR turns out to be a useful tool for doing that kind of work. Then we'll tell you a bit about what we've done, the fun we've had. It has been fun, actually. And then we'll tell you about where we're headed. And then there's a sort of a pitch at the end. So first of all, what is the U.S. Army Natick Soldier Research, Development, and Engineering Center? Well, we are a government lab that works. We do work for the Army. Natick does a broad variety of different types of things, everything from developing food, so all the rations that soldiers eat are sort of concocted at Natick. The most recent one that I learned about was the self-heating egg, the Shegg, which just sounds delicious, and I'm sure our guys in the field can't wait to enjoy the Shegg. We develop backpacks and load carriage systems. We develop camouflage. We do a lot of sort of equipment-y types of things. We also do a lot of work on sort of future technologies. So kind of up on the upper right, there's some sort of future concepts for what soldiers might sort of look like and carry 20 or 30 years in the future, if they're not replaced by robots. We've done some work on exoskeletons. So down on the bottom left is the cover of a fairly recent Popular Science magazine that featured the work that's going on at Natick in terms of developing exoskeletons for soldiers. The idea being that they can carry more, they can be bulletproof, they can fly, they can, you know, do whatever the real Iron Man might do, or Iron Woman. And then sort of I fall into this sort of lumpy gray thing on the bottom right-hand corner, which is looking at how to improve soldier performance. And particularly, I'm interested in improving how soldiers think on the battlefield, helping them make good decisions so that they don't kill the wrong people, stay alive, and try to do something about the bad people. So, why do I use virtual reality? Well, so as a cognitive scientist, I'm sort of very used to using kind of seated computer tasks, and I don't know what the psychology department is like here at WPI, or if there is one, or what. But if there is one, and if you've ever been in a psychology experiment, you've probably gone into a lab, sat down at a computer, looked at stuff on a computer screen, and pressed buttons. That's really good because it gives me a high degree of experimental control. I can control exactly what's on that screen. I can limit your attention to the stuff that I find relevant for my research, and it's a nice controlled environment. The downside, particularly for someone like me who works in a very applied setting, is that the sort of external validity of that work is quite low. So pressing buttons on a computer keyboard and looking at little flashes of light on a screen is a pretty far cry from understanding how soldiers process information when they're in the middle of a firefight in Fallujah. So control is really high. External validity is quite low. Now, I could do field studies where I go out and I actually get with soldiers and I actually have them do real-world soldier tasks. That's a lot better in terms of external validity, but the control is basically zero. I mean, I can say, hey, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, and they're not going to do what I tell them to do because, I mean, look at me. So field studies are nice for external validity, but bad for control. Well, VR is nice because it sort of splits the difference there. I can concoct a virtual environment with a high degree of fidelity that offers me also a high degree of control. So I can control what they're seeing and what they're doing, but it gives them a more lifelike experience. So for me, it's nice because it kind of splits that difference between standard lab techniques and field studies. Okay, so if we're going to do VR, what do we need to have? And I'm sorry if some of this is maybe too basic for some of you, but such is life. We sort of need these pieces. We need some computers, we need displays, we need sound, we need tracking, some way to do locomotion, so on and so forth. In terms of displays, the sort of common approaches you'll see are CAVE systems. CAVE is a recursive acronym for CAVE, Automatic Virtual Environment. It's essentially a physical space that you stand inside, made of projection screens, paired with projectors that kind of be sort of front or rear projection. And it's nice because it's a real physical space. Right? You're physically inside the environment. You don't have any cumbersome head-mounted displays on. So it's a fairly natural sort of way to interact with the virtual environment. It has limitations. One of the major ones for us is space. These typically require really big volumes of space to set up. So we do have a CAVE at Natick. That's sort of been our main development platform. We also do work with head-mounted displays as well. So we sort of have a couple different options in terms of how we present virtual reality. Locomotion is always sort of an interesting problem in VR. There isn't a perfect solution. Sort of the common ones are treadmills. So if you have millions of dollars, you can buy yourself an omnidirectional treadmill that will allow you, in theory, to walk in any direction through a virtual environment, sort of trying to be like the holodeck a bit. We do something a bit simpler. We have a self-propelled treadmill that we have linked in through a speed encoder to our virtual environments. Recently, a company came out with the thing on the left there, which is called the hamster ball, sort of colloquially, or the virtue sphere, if they're trying to sell you one. And basically, you sit inside this ball, and you can walk in principle in any direction, and you have a head-mounted display on that shows you the environment. Sort of fun, kind of hard if you fall, though, a bit uncomfortable. So you have to assemble these pieces. Now, the sort of main thing we're here to talk about today is this piece in the middle, which is the software engine. What actually does the rendering of the virtual environment for you? So if you're going to go get yourself a software engine to do VR, you have a few different options. The first one is you can go the commercial route and buy something. Now, there's many, many companies out there that would be more than happy to sell you a very nice virtual reality software engine. Cubic, CAE, SAIC, Lockheed Martin, they're great. They develop training systems for the military that are very high fidelity and very nice. Sort of two downsides for me as a researcher. First, these are extremely expensive systems. I do have, even though I work for the government, I do have limited, budget that I can work with. And also, they're proprietary. So for me, I want to be able to go in and concoct my environments to do the research I'm interested in at a given point in time. That's very hard to do with a proprietary system. I can go and pay these companies more money to rearrange things for me, but that's sort of an ongoing expense, and it's sort of slow and expensive. So not really a great solution for research. One of the things that we've looked at, and it's actually where Jeremy and I started, is in using sort of a quasi-open game-based type platform. So a lot of games that have come out recently have sort of somewhat open components to them. They might reveal functionality through a scripting language, for example. And actually, we started with Unreal Tournament as a platform for doing VR. And I think Jeremy's going to talk a bit about our experience doing that. Nice for a lot of reasons. I mean, you're able to. I can go out and buy a few copies of Unreal, spend $100 or so on four or five copies, and get access to a multi-million dollar beautiful graphics engine. So it's very nice in terms of that sort of cost-benefit ratio. Downside, of course, is that these games aren't designed to run VR applications, and there's only so much you can do with the scripting access. And Jeremy will tell you a bit about our experience there. Sort of your last option, really, is to go open source, which there aren't, in terms of research-grade virtual reality applications, you don't have that many options that are sort of available out of the box. Delta 3D is an application that was created by the Naval Postgraduate School, their MOVES Institute. It is a virtual reality platform. It's very nice. It does a lot. It's available canned. You can just download it and use it to your heart's content. My problem with it is the graphics are pretty old. It doesn't look that great. I think it's possible to do better these days. ALICE is sort of an interesting project, came out of Carnegie Mellon. Its actual purpose is to help teach young kids how to do interactive 3D graphics. So it's kind of a cool application. I did a postdoc at the University of Virginia, and we actually used ALICE in our VR lab as sort of the software engine. Very nice. It's done with Python scripting, so it's easy to work with. The graphics are really not very good at all. They're 10, 15 years old, so not great. So your third option is to build one yourself, and that's what we did, and that's primarily what Jeremy's going to talk about today. So I think, okay, so that's, and now I'll hand it over to Jeremy. So Jeremy's going to tell you a bit about Viros, which is probably the best name we've come up with. I'm not great at coming up with names for things. So this is the Virtual Reality Open Source Engine. So Jeremy's going to tell you about how that works and what we've been doing with it. So we have to sort of be low-tech here and kind of hot-swap our laptops. Viros, yeah.
Thank you. Where am I clipping? So let's clip it to my shirt somewhere. Do this. That works. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
All right. All right, so as Jason said, I am this only software engineer, actually. I mean, all right, I'm not the only one, but I am the only fully employed software engineer by trade. That's what I got my degree in. Jason does help out, like he says, but the government doesn't hire programmers in batch, not like a game design company that we don't hire artists, we don't hire a ton of programmers. Typically, they'll only have one or two, and then they'll contract out the work, which can be difficult because, as Jason said, when you have a closed-source solution, which we'll get from contractors, then you have to pay them exorbitant amounts of money to actually fix the problems that are usually there. So this is a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about, but I will get right into it. So as Jason said, we started with Unreal Tournament. For anybody who's ever looked at the VR stuff, this is KVUT. It's based on Unreal Tournament 2004. The application itself is just written in Unreal Script. You can see right here, just a quick, I don't have any idea who that guy is, I just picked the picture. But this is the typical cave setup. It's in a V-shape, project to the walls, and then it uses, you know, the game engine, and it uses Unreal Tournament spectator function to set faces up around the individual player. And then they also have their own sort of custom off-axis projection library to get, so you can stitch things together in a more realistic manner. Instead of just rotating your whole scene around, you can actually shift the whole view frustum and cut it at certain points and create a more realistic approach. And he'll actually, they don't just have the sort of the V-shape, they've actually got like a dome and a few hemispheres working out there, which is pretty cool. I've seen it in action, and it's a pretty impressive tool, especially for kids. They put it into a museum to show them dinosaurs, I think. I don't know if you remember his postdoc work. Is this yours, or is this mine? Okay, I just want to make sure I drank from your water last time. So excuse the bullets. This is just a quick overview kind of how KVUT was structured and what we found and why we had to change. So some of the pros, as I said, it's open source. It's unwritten in Unreal Script for the most part. Obviously, the engine isn't open source, so you can't actually futz with the graphics, which is a problem for us. And if there's problems, it's real problematic to debug. It's built on the Unreal Engine. There is a ton of community content out there for Unreal. There's actually a lot of Iraqi levels. Somebody did Black Hawk Down. That was one of our first levels that we actually played around with. And it had a pretty impressive setup. And they've got the weapons and the sounds and all that other stuff. And it was easy to maintain for the most part. I mean, it really didn't have to do too much. It was just a script you had to deal with and the logging files. And everything was already written. And then it also, it's a weird place to put this pro, but it had an off-axis projection library, which they intercepted calls to OpenGL in order to do their trickery, because as I said, they didn't have access to the actual graphics library. They did have was access to the code in read-only format. I've actually got read-only look at Unreal Tournament 2004 and their latest one, Unreal 3, but I can't do anything with it, so it doesn't really matter. Some of the problems, though, if anybody's ever made any levels for Unreal Tournament, the script is odd, the logic is slippery at best, and it can become problematic to maintain. You really don't have any idea when a problem arises, you don't know where it's coming from, and the only way to do it is the old-fashioned sort of brute force dump printf statements and go from there. And that can be a pain in the butt. It's nice when you can just dump a stack and go through that way. I said it's a closed source engine. You know, you can't touch the graphics, you can't touch the physics. And since it is Unreal Tournament 2004 is outdated, so the physics are pretty old school. It's really only like a ray cast through the bottom of the scene, and you know, a few others for basic objects. Nothing fancy. And then the scripting can be slow. A lot of the stuff we were trying to do needs to be high resolution. Jason informed me this, but in cognitive psychology, just psychology in general, I guess the tests have to be to within a 1 millisecond degree of accuracy. It's nice if you can get there. I'm never going to see that, so it's not so cumbersome, but it is tricky to try to get as close as possible. And we also were forced to use Unreal Ed. I don't know if anybody's ever written levels for Unreal, but Unreal Ed is a pain in the behind. And my last point says it's touchier than a masseuse. It can be finicky at best, and I despise using it with a passion. So that's more for Jason, so just to remind him of the troubles we went through. So we decided to change it up a little bit. We needed an open source system. We needed something written in a language I can deal with. C++ is what I do. I've been doing it for 7 years now. And I needed to be able to adapt to his research requirements. Because we work in a research environment, requirements will come down the pipe, and they might not be, you know, the first task might have been, okay, well, make something they can walk through, but the next one might be, well, how can they interact with it? And so things change pretty quick, and I don't know the exact turnaround on most of your research, but it's not like you don't have a couple of years to wait for the engine to be built. So we had to have something that was fairly adaptable that we could update on our own, and as I said, with only one or two programmers, which leads us to our Frankenstein Vyros software. It is a combination of closed but free and open source libraries. So you can see right there, we have the Havok physics engine. For those that aren't familiar, it's a AAA physics engine used in a lot of games. Most of the most recent ones. I actually didn't print out any examples, but you can find it on their website. What's it? Yeah. RackNet, open source networking library. FMod is for sound, and then, of course, Ogre for graphics. And this makes my job extremely easy, because all I have to do is build a framework to deal with each of the individual units. I don't have time to keep them all updated. Did you have a question?
Is it source for
Havok? No. No, but it's free for research purposes and for home use. If you want to release it, I think they charge you then their exorbitant fee.
But for research, you still don't have the source.
No. No. The reason I chose that over the open source solutions that are out there was ODE, I think, and Bullet. Their community examples were pretty sucky, and I needed to do this fast, and Havok had a great library of demos, and so it was just so much easier for me to throw in. We looked at PhysX, and again, I had trouble just following their examples. The few that they had were sort of non-specific.
That's actually where we started, was using PhysX. In particular, implementing a character controller that would interact nicely with Ogre and actually get a person to walk on the ground without falling through the way it was
streamed. It was tricky, but that's not to say we can't do it. It's highly modular, so the way the subsystem's set up, I could just call it, and then I just have to link to their system that way if I decided to go back to it for some reason. So for us, it was nice. It was a quick startup time. All the engines were pre-built. That was the easy part. There's a very established community for most of these. Open source I love the communities for open source software because they're very... They frequently answer questions on the forums, and they do it, you know, pretty well, especially for free. I mean, you can't really beat that. Although I can't complain, the Havok forums are actually pretty well flooded with their developers. I don't know why they're maintaining the community so well, but I'm not going to complain. It is scalable. It is easier in many ways to debug. As I said, because it's in C++, I can easily do a stack trace. Havok actually has a beautiful debugger built in. They actually have a visual debugger.
What does FMod do?
Oh, I'm sorry. FMod is closed source but free sound system. Yep. Scalability in terms of meeting Jason's requirements for his projects. So that if he has...
Is that scalability or flexibility?
Well,
scalability means I can do a million people or a million objects or a million simultaneous voice channels.
It could be. I think I look at it as it could be both. Because we start small and I have to... I scale things up, I guess is how I look at it. So it can be scaled to that point.
But you don't know from a number of objects and number of people, number of players... Do you have a number on how many players you can support simultaneously?
32 without any problems. That's what I've tested in the lab so far. And that's with our minimal environment that we have. We pay for content on the fly, so, yeah.
you look at OpenAL for the audio?
We did. Jason could actually speak to that better than I could. I didn't look at it for any particular reason.
So one of the things I like about FMod is that part of the API includes a really nice set of tools for doing sort of blocking sounds based on 3D geometry. So you can feed FMod a set of 3D volumes to represent the buildings or whatever the environment, and it will actually calculate sound obstruction. I believe it does some reverberation. So it's very nice in that regard.
Okay, I'm not sure where I was, but anyways, yeah, so this faster development time because things are pre-built and I'm just dealing with the framework. It is a smaller group, so it can be easier to maintain. I don't have to merge content changes from a ton of people. I stick with a specific version and I'll make updates very slowly. And it's free. None of this cost us any money. The content does, but I'll get to that in a minute. So yeah, what is there to see? It's a problem. We don't have full-time artists, and the content that's out there for purchase is not fantastic. There's also no sort of synergy between an artist and a programmer. They don't develop something and then say, well, can we do this now and make it look this way? We don't have that. We just get the model or the world, and we throw it in. And then there's me developing content, and I'm a programmer, as I said. My content sucks. It is ugly, ugly content, and I'm embarrassed by it. But what we do have are 3D scans. Before I worked with Jason, I actually split my time between the cognitive psychology group and an anthropology group, and we have a whole body scanner, which, by the way, if anybody ever wants to use it, it's free for use for anybody, really. And we can take whole bodies, scan them, convert them to models, and actually import them into the game. And they look okay, and it creates a nice realistic effect in that we can scan soldiers that we're then going to put into the game environment. And it's not just a simple texture wrap, it's their body dimensionality. Now, obviously, I don't know if anybody knows 3D scanning technology, but typically what it exports is a 300,000K polygon model, which is I'm never going to be able to render that in real time. So I have to decimate down, so I do lose a lot of the surface information, but I can keep the texture, the original texture, so it is somewhat realistic. Or procedural content. That's the last solution that we've been sort of playing around with. So the example is Spore, that's the recent one. Say what you will about the game, but the procedural content was a pretty impressive feat, at least I thought it was. We can also use Pinocchio. It's actually an open source package written by a guy named Ilya out of MIT. It can automatically rig bone structure to a human body, or any body for that matter, as long as you have the initial base skeleton. It can rig it, it can do the skin deformation, and it can dump it out, and you can attach mocap data to it. So you can have your model and not have to be an animator, which I'm not. There's Genetica. We use it for textures. It's a great little tool. I don't think that's actually free anymore. I think they've started charging for it, so probably have to pull that off sometime soon. Unfortunately. And then there's SpeedTree. It's one of the common AAA ones out there. Gears of War 2, they did the trees in that, I believe. So I guess just to summarize what all it is, so what in God's name is this thing? It's just an open source framework. It's a VR environment very similar to the KVUT thing that I specified before. It is a cave environment. That's how we have it set up. We have off-axis built in instead of having to have a kludge that goes through OpenGL. So this way we can build it into Direct 3D, which I much prefer to deal with those constructs. It's similar in features as well. We have spectators. You attach a spectator to a specific view, and then you rotate it around and create your scene from that. In theory, we could have any number of users in their own caves in the environment. And then, as I said, it's modular, can adapt, and it is a research tool. That's the primary focus of all of it. And I don't know if I mentioned it, it's free. So this is the setup. Excuse the word barf on this. I couldn't think of another way of putting this information up there. This is Jason kind of showed a slide entailing what we have, but this is the actual setup itself. We have a motion tracker, a treadmill, an M4 mockup, and a gamepad, the actual walls to the system, and then the basic hardware. So the motion tracker is, it's high resolution, infrared. Highball? Okay. Yeah, it's tethered, which is one of the downsides to it.
So are you only tracking the head?
Mm-mm.
Do you have another one on the gun prop?
You can do either or. We do the gun prop. We put it at the tip of that. We put the beacon down there. So we don't track head movement.
It's pretty big, right? It's lightweight though, so it doesn't add, The biggest problem is just the big old tether that comes out of it.
So you're only tracking, are you using stereo?
Not in this particular application. So I do have a head-mounted display that's obviously capable of doing
stereo. No, but even in stereo on K.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, we don't in this particular.
You're not, okay. So you don't need to track, the reason I ask is you really need to track the head.
Right, but for our purposes, we have a set, and it's the calibration is tricky because you calibrate it to the head height to make sure that the seams stitch together well. We have another highball tracker. We could just as easily track the head. The software will handle it. I just don't have it in there right now. So Jason said we have a treadmill. It's self-propelled, just sits on the floor. You just push yourself along. There's no force sensors, so it has no idea if you're turning. All it does is give you forward motion. What you can do then, though, is use the gamepad, which is mounted on the M4 mock-up. And it's a kludgy way of doing it, but it does allow them. M4 is a weapon, yes. And the mock-up is, it's as real as it can be. It's the same weight, same size, all the dimensionality. It has an air compressor for recoil, if you actually want that type of realism. And you can also put a USB controller on the trigger so that you can trigger events. We just trigger a simple gunshot sound, but you could do other things. So there's the gamepad as well. Just a typical cheap gamepad, just moves left and right. Allows them to turn in the environment if there isn't somebody controlling it from behind the scenes. So there's the walls, whatever, the V-shaped system. Each wall itself, you can see the split down the middle of the picture right there. Each one of those is a separate wall, and each one it has its own computer and projector. So total, we have 6 computers. So we have 4 clients, which run each of the walls individually. There's 4 projectors for those clients, a server, and then there's the motion tracker, which has to be on its own sort of standalone machine. The highball server, it uses everything it can, all of the resources, so it tends to slow things down. And then it's in a gigabit router system. This will run over a regular network, but it won't run well. I've run it across my wireless at home, and it gets a little glitchy.
What operating system do you use?
Windows.
Everything is Windows?
Everything has to be Windows because we're government. I know. We would love to switch, but there's nothing we can do. And it's the community we work in, too. So.
Vista?
What's that?
Vista?
No, we thankfully had XP on these only. But we have been forced to Vista and on all the rest of the machines now, yes.
Actually, this is sort of funny. So the government is just switching to Vista. We all just have this email that all of our computers have to be upgraded to Vista in the next couple of months. So basically just in time for Windows 7 to upgrade to Vista.
Yeah. So it's a sad state of affairs. I would love to switch, but what can you do? This is just a quick, let's see if, hopefully this doesn't lock it up. It was doing it last night, but this is a video of the environment. We're only projecting on one screen. There was a setup already going in there that we had to move around. So you'll see, this is one of our colleagues, Tony. He's tethered to the treadmill and he's moving himself along. He's doing the turning itself with the gamepad. Yeah, it's on the M4 itself, right under his thumb. So you can move it around like that. And you can see, I know it's tricky here, I actually have a close-up video, but you can see a reticle, right, kind of swerving across a little crosshair. It will cross all the screens, and that's actually based off where the M4 is going and the highball tracker. Once calibrated, it should be as accurate as it can be. I mean, it's
why is that realistic? The world's giving you a reticle.
Well, I know it doesn't, but for these purposes, we can't just get, when we can turn it off if we want. Yeah, so it's there for effect.
Steps and he's going really fast.
Disconcerting. Yeah. When we did the demo, because I had to switch to 2 new computers that were also wiped, I had no time to fix it up. It's controlled by speed. It will propel realistically. When I was setting this up, though, it had a 0 to, as fast as it can go. So that's why he kind of... And I take over right here manually to do it, just for the looking around. So you see the looking around the environment. You can see the stitching problems between the 2 screens. There was a little bit of network lag going on right now that I didn't have time to deal with for making the video. It's what's that? Between the 2 computers themselves over the network, yeah. Yeah, you can see it. We also didn't have time to align everything up, so there is just a little bit of offset. And what you see here too is, like I said, it's our free content, so it's not great looking. It's okay, and as you can probably see, there's no shadowing. This is an example of the Havoc engine in motion, and you can see the objects are stitched across the screen, and they will spin and bounce and whatever realistically. So you won't see two different boxes on both sides. They should line up across the split screen, which are two different computers.
I think you just jumped off a building.
Yes. Yeah. We've killed the realism on that part. You won't die from falling off a building. We can put it in there if we want to, but I disabled most of it for this.
The treadmill is motor-driven?
Self-propelled.
What does that mean? Human drives it?
Yep. It tethers you at your waist, and you sort of lean against it, and you push.
The notion of self, I had to figure out what that meant.
Yeah. Oh, my bad.
It's driving itself.
Yeah, it just goes and tries to figure out what you're doing.
There's no sensors, that was my question.
Yeah, well, it's that smart. We drafted one of the most amazing AIs. It just knows where he wants to go. Yeah. It's our ESP AI paper. So,
does...
Yeah, well, it's amusingly enough, they didn't know how to implement their USB drivers. It's a USB to their headboard, but they couldn't tell me how to get that information to a computer. So we had to put our own encoder in there, otherwise we were stuck with Ethernet. You can see there, as Jason mentioned, the highball beacon is mounted, or whatever you want to call it, at the tip of the M4. It does tend to drag it down just a little bit, but it's not bad. I mean, it's for the accuracy we get, it's not a bad solution. There's just a closer up of it. Jason's amazing metal bending skills at the bottom there. That was by hand, folks. That was impressive. It's Dr. Gustin. He's crazy strength like Hulk.
Is this an airsoft rifle? No, this is actually, this actually comes from a company called LaserShot. They make marksmanship training systems. And actually, the full LaserShot system is the rifle, the laser
Oops.
Emitter, and then there's a set of laser detectors out on the range. Just block the rifles from another thing. Because they're actually made by their exact weapon.
And it's just a better view of what the cursor looks like as it crosses. Just to give an example that it will slide across the screen. It's a little jittery because of the lag, but if I had the better example, it would be fine. We just recently fixed the networking problems we were having. There was some latency issues. That's why we use a gigabit router, though. It keeps everything nice and smooth. It's not too bad. I like it.
Just a word on the content. So again, the content is something that we actually got off the Turtle Squid. So it sort of is what it is. If you go look at Ogre's website and download the demos, you can see Ogre is a very, very capable 3D graphics engine. So it can do particle effects, it can do sort of full range of things that you would expect from a modern graphics engine. Our paid for content, I did actually pay for that content.
Yes.
How your current sample content might not give you a full sense of what.
How much to the end of your speech do you have? Because I've got a few more slides and the little demo and not a ton of time. I didn't want to blitz through it and miss anything. But we have a different design process than sort of your typical game studio because we are a research entity. So, again, excuse the bullets, but we'll gin up a quick design document. We were joking about this before, which it would really just be a couple of sticky notes that I pasted onto a piece of paper that I would scan in here. That's my design document. I do work half-time for two different groups, so I have very limited time to sort of deal with the finer things, which can cause problems. I've had to go back to redraft the framework a couple of times. As I said, we decided on the language. We found the existing libraries, and then I started prototyping various subsystems, the animation subsystem, the weather, the lighting, the soft shadows that we have, a few other things, and then I integrated them all at the end, and that worked pretty well. And then started coding the framework, and then I'll just sort of refine to meet ongoing requirements as Jason, when he steps down from his ivory tower and doles out to his minions or me, and I refine the code, and I continue weeping softly because it's hard. But we're not, like I said, we're not your typical game designer. We don't have a testing and feedback stage. We don't have the time. It sort of goes on as we do projects. The soldiers might say something, and then we'll say, okay, well, we can fix that for the next round. Or, Jason will go through and say, okay, well, I need this to do this now. What's up?
So your success criteria, is basically how many papers Jason can publish?
Yeah.
Or what is it?
Yeah. How many can Jason push out? Yep. Yeah, exactly. But we do have time constraints. Everything is developed as needed. That's the only way we can do it. It's the limited number of programmers really precludes any other sort of way of doing things. As I mentioned before, there's a high degree of accuracy required for this. We are a research entity, so we do have to do things a little bit differently. We try to keep as high level of fidelity with the real world as we can. Obviously, you saw our level. It's not hyper-realistic in that everything has a very 90-degree angle to it. Content is paid for. We don't have artists. We'll never have artists, I don't think. We hope to. We would like to. That would be great. But government work doesn't seem to attract artistry. They don't really have a high need for it generally. And then we sort of reel like drunkards from project to project. We have a lot of them. In my other group, I do take on projects. I don't ever have a finished solution, basically. I just have to keep doing modules or packets and then just go from there. So this is what I was talking about here. This is an example of our 3D scanner, or one of the scans. This is me wearing combat armor. You can see on the far left, that's what our scanner looks like. That's a highly decimated version. That's, I don't know, 20,000 polygons, down from 300,000. So it's whole body. I cut the hands and the head off because the program that does the animation requires it to be a very clean surface, and the hands and head are just difficult to deal with, especially the hair. But what we can do is we can import it into a program called SciSlice. It's from Headis. It's a great tool. It's expensive, as all get out, but it will export sub-D and NURB surfaces for our 3D meshes. So that's one way we can get the content pipe. And you see here I've just quickly done a patch on my back, and then the right is the resulting sub-D surface, which then I can port into Blender and then put into our environment. And his program will actually allow you to do, you can project the texture from the original scan into that, so he'll export all that stuff. So you don't lose the details. As you can see, the one on the right kind of smoothed a lot of the detail of the vest out. And I think I include it later. This is our content pipe for level design. We obtain it from some third party, import it into Blender. That's to deal with just, you know, exporting it into the Ogre format and to make any changes we want to make, or Maya. We import it into Giles, which is a free tool to do soft shadowing, and it saves the light map afterwards. It's a cute little tool. It's not great in that it doesn't export to the original UV map of the texture that came in, so you have to do some realignment yourself and reproject it down, which it's not too hard. It's a hassle. And then import the object or whatever, the pieces of the level, into Havok to export the physical model itself so that your object doesn't, or your dude doesn't fall through the floor. And it's multiple formats. So that it's the Ogre standard mesh format for that. And then they have a material script, which is what I use the light mapping in. And then there's the HKX, which is the Havok physics file. At some point, I will merge them in to make one solid cohesive element.
One of our big projects that I'll touch on yet is coming up with some type of level designer that will automate the creation of those different models.
All right, so here's just a quick example of one of the prototypes I was doing. So I wanted to deal with a weather system. You can see it's chugging at 15 frames. This is a workstation graphics card, so it's not going to do super well. But you can see there is water. It does have reflective effects. You can go under the water, and it will actually sort of shine the little lights through. Unfortunately, right now, it doesn't work perfectly. If I go behind solid mesh, it doesn't stop those lights, so it just sort of blurs through everything. It does project a nice little texture across the surface of the water, or the object under the water. It does a decent job. This particular version, this is infinite water, so it will go on for forever, supposedly. But it's at a cost. I mean, this is expensive. And then just a little catapult in the middle. It really didn't do much else. Although, so that's Blender's version of an exported shadow. It's hard to see up there. It's pretty aliased. It's not great. I don't know if you can actually see this from the. So you can see it dropped a light source, and it will actually then. So the two thin lines, that's from the new light source that I just dropped. I can drop soft shadowing light around. This was sort of a demo for all those things, and I'll have a closer up one that'll show a little bit more of what we've done. But you can see it's gotten down to 7 frames a second, this laptop itself.
So which graphics card is in there?
This is the NVIDIA something or other, not the Quadro, what's the other one? They have like a laptop, I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
When I picked it up, it wasn't, as I think you might have heard, we're limited in what we can do.
Right. I just like to, you can compare game engines to game engines somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, typically, I run this on my, I have an 8800 on my main computer, and that's what, and it runs butter smooth, and I can run it down to, I think I've run it on a 34, I can never remember what we have another older computer that I'll run it on, it runs fine. Model design, almost exactly the same. Obtain the content from a third party, put it into Blender. We will animate with Pinocchio. That's our best option right now. We don't have riggers. We're in the process of taking on that task of trying to figure out how to do it ourselves. But we're not animators. We don't do that sort of thing. And then we also can assign sort of the ragdoll and the physicality in Havok. So they're ragdoll right now is one of the prototypes I'm working on. It hasn't actually been implemented, but it is there somewhat. Right now, the dude, his head will just kind of lull backwards. And then that all goes into Viros, and we'll tweak and retexture as needed. Actually, that is where my other demo comes. So you can see, if you remember that, I showed you that scan of me. All right, so this is actually done in real time. It'll take a second. You'll see it freeze up for a minute. You won't actually see anything until it comes through. But this is, I took my mesh of me that I showed before of wearing the armor, and there's no animation, there's no skeleton, there's no anything. And this will rig it, and it will, you can kind of see, so you can see a dude just walking around. And that was all done sort of on the fly. The skin deformation is actually done by the engine right now. Obviously, I would export that to Vertex Track if I could. But for now, for the demo purposes, I'll do it as needed. So yeah, so he'll walk around. This is, if you download Pinocchio, I include the link on my thing. This is one of the stock mocaps he includes. The program isn't fully developed. It doesn't deal with open sort of any, like you can go to Carnegie Mellon and get free mocap data. We have a motion capture facility which deals with the Iron Man biomech suit that you saw there, the exoskeleton. They did all that work, and they have a mocap facility, and we can get the data from them. We all work really closely together on a lot of projects. Maybe not the same thing, but they'll provide content. So anyways, you just see him running around there. And then, let's see. So the last demo is a smaller version of Viros running. So it's that same level you saw in the video, only I've kind of cleaned it up just a little bit and darkened it. I didn't realize that the projectors would project it as dark as they did. But it is the same sort of Afghani environment. You can see I've pulled a few things out that I shouldn't have. I was just quickly pulling things as I could. But it does have, this is a variance soft shadow map right here. So you can see, here I'll drop it and go to the side. It does cast them pretty well. You can see at the bottom by the tires, it does, close to the mesh, it doesn't blend as it's supposed to. I was working on a different form of blurring, and it's causing those issues, because it does tend to lag just a little bit. So you can see our environment. We have our little, let's see if they drop. So I have little worlds and little stuff that I just spit around, so you can push them around and sort of knock them around the environment, and they will react. This is all Havok-based. It's real easy stuff. To put in there, the primitives. And last, so this will lock it up again. It's that same animation, but just to show you that it can be applied to a different model. So you'll see the same walking posture or motion. Let's see if this, there we go. So, oops, forget where I am. All right, so we have our little dude. If I drop this, I move to the side. So you can see, it's the same animation you saw before. You can see it projected onto the wall behind him. So the variant soft shadows do apply. You can leave them, drop them. This is why I use Giles, though. This is not a great solution for doing global illumination. It's pretty crappy, in fact. It's only good for close-up, for flashlights, for tiny lights in rooms. So what I'll do is I'll pre-bake most of my textures, most of my light maps, with a global illumination scheme like Giles. And then I'll put them in, and then we'll have this. And that's, aside from my links, is that. So, there you go. I'll turn it back to Jason.
So it's okay if I post your slides?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I include all the links on the to all the stuff on there. There you go. You see?
Pockets. A lot of good exploration of tools and your choices, since you're doing them.
Yeah.
You do a lot of research, so you try a lot of things.
Well, that's the nice thing, too, about everything. Nowadays, there are so many open standards and so many things.
Well, if you talk about standards, the great thing about them is there's so many.
Right.
Yeah,
right. Right. And Jeremy has really done an excellent job of basically pulling together a fully functional piece of software really on his own. So I joke about having made it. My contribution is like, one or two lines of code. He's really really sort of been the architect of this whole thing. So you sort of saw where we're at. A lot of work left to be done. Currently, we have no AI system. For me, that's important because I want to be able to put people into an environment and have them interact, for example, with simulated Iraqi villagers, for example. So we're looking at AI scripting. We want to put a scripting language integrated with the framework. Currently, it's all hard code C++ stuff with INI files. That's fine for people like Jeremy and I, but I'd like this to be usable by people who don't know C++. So we're looking at Python. Lua is another option. I like Python because it has sort of a richer framework for scientific computing. A big project for us is some kind of level designer and some kind of asset control. Currently, this is just sort of concocted in Blender, not very efficient. That turns out to be an interesting challenge in and of itself. Getting content, my hope is I can sort of build up a library of decent content over time. We're still working on visual fidelity. We can implement shaders in Ogre, and Jeremy's been working on that. The FMod implementation that we have so far, you didn't see it today, is an example of my fantastic coding ability. It's very basic. FMod is a very capable engine, so we'd like to sort of build a richer implementation of FMod into the software. And currently there are really no GUIs or menus, which is, again, fine for us, but at some point it would be nice to have a more user-friendly interface. Which sort of gets me to my last point, which is another reason for the talk today, which is to sort of put out a call for help, paid help, as it turns out. So I have a need for one or two summer interns. These would be paid internship positions. It's not. We do have a beach. I wouldn't swim in the water at Lake Kachituate, but we do have a beach. So one or two paid internship positions for the summer. They pay quite well, certainly better than Best Buy or the pizza joint or Stop and Shop or what have you. We're a reasonably okay bunch of people to work with, I think. I think I'm all right to work with. So it's a nice, so your options for the summer, you could, of course, go off and spend the summer, in Cancun on the beach relaxing, but then you'd have to worry about sunburns and sharks and other unpleasantness. So I think really for a student, it would be much more rewarding to come to Natick and work for us over the summer. You can do programming, you can make money. You can get job experience, and this is experience actually working on doing interactive media development. So for those of you who are students in this program, it's directly relevant job experience. Go right on your resume, and I think it would be a nice opportunity for you. And again, because we're a small group, it's a chance to have a pretty high impact on a project. For example, your job might be make us that level designer. So you're not just sort of doing scut work. We've got real work to do. And with that, come work for Uncle Sam. We'll try to treat you right. And that's really all we had.